Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Rebecca Wildbear. She's a river and soul guide who helps people tune into the mysteries that live within the Earth community, dreams, and their own wild nature, so they may live a life of creative service. She's been a guide with the Animas Valley Institute since 2006 and is author of the forthcoming book, Playing and Praying, Soul Stories to Inspire Personal and Planetary Transformation. She also created Wild Yoga, a practice of worship, veneration, and advocacy for the Earth. So first, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So recently you wrote an essay called Deepen Your Ecological Perception that seemed to me just sort of in many ways to manifest the very essence of animism or articulate the essence of animism. So can you talk a little bit about that essay?
It speaks to just my absolute love to the wild world and what makes sense to me. And I think what makes sense even to young children inherently if they're left out in the natural world, and what made sense to the first people that lived on the land is that everything's alive. And what makes sense to you, Derek, and all your books is that everything is alive and everything is to be in relationship with, and we're connected to everything and we can have relationship with everything, and we do have relationship with everything, whatever kind of relationship it is, but we can have an intentional relationship with everything. We can have a conversation. And in many ways, the things that I wrote are things that I haven't written or said outside of a lot of groups that I guide, because in the mainstream dominant culture, they're considered pretty, you know, kind of crazy really, because everything's sort of turned on its head and the mainstream dominant world is crazy. So these ideas seem crazy, but they really, they're pretty basic, in that we're in relationship with everything. Whatever we do to everything, it affects us, and we can talk and have conversations, and in fact that all of the others are quite intelligent, and I feel like in most cases, although every being is unique, but in most cases they want a relationship with us, especially a respectful, communicative, ceremonial, sacred kind of relationship. And I've been very fortunate in my life to get to do that work a lot of the time. I'm out in the wild having these kinds of conversations, myself and also with groups of people, bringing them out there to have those kinds of conversations. So in that world, it's like, it's pretty normal, pretty much what we do. And then, in the everyday world, it's not, but this article was kind of an attempt to sort of try to communicate a little bit of what I do out there on the land, in a way that maybe anybody and everybody could understand it. Cause, you know, understanding that what would make a big impact or difference in our world is to have, you know, well, everybody if possible, but it's certainly as many people as we can in the world, as many humans having this kind of relationship with the earth would be a good idea.
When you say having conversations with wild creatures, what do you mean?
Well, you know, I can mean anything. There can be any number of kinds of conversations. They don't always have to be, you know, verbal, conversations. You know, our presence in the presence of another is in a relationship and is in a conversation. It doesn't have to be, words out loud spoken back and forth. But it can be, and it sometimes is. And if it's wanted that kind of relationship to happen, that's certainly within the realm of something that can happen. But if we go out into nature and expect that it's going to look or be a certain particular way or a way that we're familiar with, then usually usually it's not. I always joke with people that, you know, you're not going to go out and have a mick conversation where you just start talking and then you're going to have this back and forth like you're used to in the human world. But if you've never, you know, tried to talk to nature, so it can start out with just, you know, watching the others, just entering their world and observing what they do and seeing what's happening and seeing how you feel and notice what comes up in you as you watch all of the others. So that there's all sorts of levels of conversation, but yes, it can actually be a conversation where, I like to think about it not as trying to get something back from nature, because that, you know how it is. with humans, we want something. So it can be really easy to go out in the land and you know, want something, like ask a particular question and want an answer. And it's okay to do that, but it's sort of like if I came up to you at a party, Derek, and I just, you know, I didn't know you very well, and I just sort of shook you and said, "Can you tell me about my future?" You know, it's like, you know, that's not really the way that you start a relationship. It's, you know, it starts out slowly by going out to the others and noticing them, and noticing who they are, and maybe saying a little bit about yourself and what you notice or what it feels like to be around them. And so, you know, so there's a lot of ways to be in conversation. It's from the very basic beginning of just being present with the others and attending and seeing to having a back and forth conversation.
Well, I'm thinking a couple things. One of them is that you're saying that some people might expect to go out into the wild and then have a conversation like you would have with a human. But the truth is, right now, if I got in the car and drove to Walmart and walked into the frozen food aisle and walked up to the first person I met and said to them, and expected to have the same conversation with them that I'm having with you right now, everybody in Walmart would think I was crazy. And so my point is that even with humans, I think if people walk into nature and expect for everybody to be paying attention, to want to have a conversation with them right then, that would be kind of crazy. We don't even expect that of humans. But somehow when it comes to non-humans, if we don't get a conversation in 10 seconds, we think, oh, well, it's not going to happen.
Yep. Totally. Yeah. And also with nature, it's like there's lots of ways it communicates. So, you're listening for the way that it communicates back, and it's a different language. It's also like if you might imagine going to another country and trying to talk to somebody, and then if you couldn't understand things immediately, just, you know, giving up that, like, oh, well, I guess, you know, we can't connect because we speak really different languages.
Well, Germans don't actually speak because they're not speaking English.
Yeah, totally.
Well, and actually, this morning I had it's a very small conversation, but this morning I was asleep and the dog needed to go to the bathroom, so he started pawing at the side of the bed until he woke me up. And I mean, if you can't speak English and say, "Hello, Derek, could you open the door for me?" How are you going to do it? And that's a pretty trivial example, but it's. I want to go a different direction. That when I was, before I wrote A Language Older Than Words, originally the book was supposed to be about our experiences of interspecies communication. But when I talked to people, what I found was that there was a real dissonance between their public and private statements on it. So many would say, "Oh my gosh, I've had these intense relationships with a certain grove of trees or a river, or the river came and said this to me," but they would always say, "I can't say this in public though, because I'm really scared that everybody think I'm crazy." So do you experience that dissonance between people's public and private experience of their relationships with non-humans?
Totally, completely. And, you know, in the work that I do, guiding groups where we all are out there talking to nature, everybody seems to be really kind of relieved and at ease and, you know, just thrilled that they can just simply be in a place where they can just talk about their conversations with nature openly without having to try not to talk about them. So I would say even as a person that's been talking to nature for more than a couple decades, I generally have not tried all that much to tell people outside of the circles who show up and want to learn about that and engage in that way. You know, I will mention that I talk to nature to pretty much everybody in the mainstream world. You know, if it comes up, I won't lie about it. But I won't necessarily mention it. But people don't ask a lot of questions. If they're not into it, even family members, you know, like, will make a joke about it, but they won't say, "Well, gosh, well, what did you say?" Or there's like a real, there's a real wall, it seems like, between people who love that and people who, it's just so weird, we can't even ask questions or talk about it. And so the people that actually do want to talk about it love congregating with other people who like to talk about it. And yeah, I don't know quite why it is that, I mean, that's been my experience. And I'm very conservative about what I share about my, conversations in the natural world. They're intimate and private. And actually, Derek, you know, your writing has somewhat inspired me to be bolder in what I think about putting out to the world that they might not get, but be willing to say it anyway. Because I would say in my life, I haven't taken those risks as much. And, it seems really important to do so, but there's a big difference. And, people who really want to talk about those experiences and aren't able to, in most mainstream contexts.
So let's demystify. I'm trying to, you know, there's this idea that if you say, I had this conversation with a squirrel or a bear or a tree, there's this sort of notion that you immediately fall into the woo-woo territory. And it seems to me, I mean, some of it can be pretty open to interpretation, as when, I mean, a great example for me is that I used to think a long time ago that walking helped my writing, that I'm thinking about some idea, and if I just walk, then that somehow shakes something loose. But it took a few years to realize that actually what was happening was very place-based, and if I walk through a city, I don't get the same responses as if I walk through a forest and say, okay, so can you help me figure out what I should say next in the book? I'm stuck here. And so they can be very, and we can go more cosmic and woo-woo in a minute, but I wanted to just say that example as one of the things that's sort of on the farther edge, but on the nearer edge is stuff that's really tangible. And I think, what am I trying to get at? That people, I really want for people to understand that non-humans are just other beings with lives that are just as, in many ways, mundane as yours and mine. And if we happen to intersect, we can say hello. Do you see what I'm getting at with this?
Yeah, it seems like that it doesn't have to be, there doesn't have to be as big of a gap as there is between the idea of having a conversation and having one. They're there, and you can have a conversation. And is there something else? And there's something I want to add too, but go ahead. Is there some other thing I didn't quite get?
Well, so yeah, please do add the thing. And then also while you're doing it, can you talk about some of the sort of tangible and most and least woo-woo of the conversations you've had? We can do more woo-woo ones later, but just sort of ease people into the shallow end of the pool, like with the dog waking me up this morning because he had to go out and pee. And so can you give, so say the thing that you wanted to say, and then also bring in some of your most tangible, or how did you move from, oh gosh, I'm just going to take a walk in a forest, to, oh my gosh, I'm actually participating in conversations. So that's what I want to get at.
Yeah, great. And I think that's related to where I wanted to go as well. But let me just make one comment too about the dog story that you mentioned, which I think is fascinating, because certain animals, you know, like dogs, probably most people would feel that dogs communicate with us. They do. We know what they're thinking. We know what they want. They find ways to communicate with us. And interestingly, like an animal like a dog that can walk on its legs and like look at you with eyes and breathe and move around and, you know, scratch you with his paw and bark, you know, that's a different kind of being than, say, you know, a flower or a tree that just, you know, stands in place. And so, you know, certain beings have ways of getting their points across, you know, like they find a way, they're more active in like making sure they communicate. And other beings, it's like, you know, maybe they're not necessarily like that. It doesn't mean they don't communicate. It's just that they're not necessarily like going to come actively try and get your attention or communicate something. But to your point of basic strategies.
Wait, I want to say something about that real quick. Sorry. That, It could also be that we are not equipped with the sensory perception capacity to understand what some of them are saying, by which I mean a lot of plants communicate pretty effectively through pheromones and through sending off chemical signals to other plants to communicate, hey, there's some caterpillars eating on my leaves, so you might want to change the taste and chemical composition of your leaves to so you don't get eaten too. And we don't have the capacity to perceive that. Or a great example is, I just love this, that honeybees see ultraviolet. And if you put ultraviolet onto all sorts of flowers, you'll see little arrows pointing to where the bees are supposed to go. You'll see, so sometimes they may actually be communicating and we can't perceive. It's not that they don't necessarily communicate actively.
Oh, I agree. I agree completely. And I think I meant to say maybe they're not that interested in communicating with us humans. Maybe they might not have something to say to us, like the same way your dog had something to say with you. But I completely agree that they're communicating with each other absolutely all the time. Okay, and sometimes they might even be communicating with us too, and we just don't know their language. We can't hear them, and they are trying to say something to us. But yeah, the back to the basics. I would say, you know, before when I was young, I had a sense that everything was alive before I was taught that I wasn't, that it wasn't. I was, before I unlearned that, and like I communicated with trees and rocks and completely felt like they were alive, and it didn't happen in words really, it just happened in being present with them, like my body against their body and a beingness that like wanted to be with more, like, I wonder why it is that I always go want to climb in a tree as a kid. Like that's where I want to be almost all the time. So, there's a communication happening there, but it's not words. And I think that level of communication happens with a lot of people in the world who might not say that they quote talk to nature, is that they just, why is it that I want to go swim in the ocean all the time? Or why is it that I want to go for a walk in the forest? Like you said, walking in the forest. Why is it that that's a place that feels like I can clear my mind? And, or why is it a place where I feel most at home and most relaxed? Or why is it a place where I just feel most alive or comfortable or happy and content like myself? Why is it the place I most want to be? Why do I keep going back to nature? And if there's a specific tree or whether you like water or trees or whatever it is you like, why do I always return to that place or that being that I like being with? So there's no words there. There's no woo woo. There's no communication. It's just, there's an actual, my body's choosing to go there and I feel a certain way when I'm there. So something's happening, even if you can't quite register what it is. And I would say, you know, that's kind of the level that I communicated when I was, you know, younger, because I worked at summer camp. That was my favorite job. I was, you know, so I could be the most possible outside. I was an Outward Bound instructor, so I could be outside. I was a wilderness therapist in part, so I could be outside. Like my body knew, like, hey, I'm happier outside. And then even the, you know, I worked for a long time in the field of, wilderness therapy. And of course that's, you know, not the highest level, obviously, of communication, because it's humans healing themselves in the wilderness. But there is there's a fascinating dynamic that I witnessed happened over all the years that I worked there. And these are people that generally did not talk to nature in the way that we're talking about. There was a few that did. I certainly offered it when it seemed like they would be open to it, but of course most weren't. When they arrived in the wilderness, they did not want to be there. They wanted to go home. And for the first 24 to 40 hours, they spent convincing me, get me out of here. Like, I've learned what I need to learn. I want to go. I'm not going to get anything out of this, you know, trying to get out. Maybe even the first week in the letters that they wrote home. But after 2 months, by the end of the time there, about 95% of the time, these people that didn't want to come into the wilderness did not want to leave it. They did not want to go back because they knew and they could feel that they were healthier, they were happier, they were a better version of themselves. They were more alive. They were enjoying life. So I think the basic, one of the most basic of the basic, is just noticing that you actually feel healthier, better, and you're attracted to being in nature.
So before we go on with the more of the talking with nature, can you talk a little bit more about the wilderness therapy? That sounds really important to me.
Yeah, is there anything in particular you want to know or about people's relationship with nature or anything?
Just, probably a lot of listeners don't know what it is. And can you do like a 5-minute introduction to what it is and how it helps people?
Yeah, in general, in wilderness therapy, I worked with groups of young adolescent girls at times and groups of young adolescent boys at other times. And towards the end, I worked almost exclusively with young adults, which were 18 and over. The young teens often would get sent against their will. Their parents could sign them in without their consent. 18 and over always had to agree to go, but they were often coerced by, you know, certain situations like, you know, this is your last chance or we won't financially support you. So it wasn't necessarily like they were like thrilled with the idea most of the time of being there. And oftentimes still they did want to go home. But with 18 and over, they could choose to walk out. They could choose to leave. So they had to kind of find their own commitment. But, with all of them, they usually came because there was no other things that were working. Almost all of them had spent some time in therapy, some time in, you know, other kinds of remediation first. You know, this was like a last ditch effort. Nothing else was working, so we'll send them into the wilderness. And, you know, there's a lot of different kinds of wilderness programs, Hoods in the Woods and different things. And the ones that I worked in were not very punitive. They were much more like, safe emotional environments to express your feelings, to learn positive ways of communication. But you also learned a lot of independent living skills, like primitive living skills, like how to make a shelter, how to carry a backpack, how to make a bedroll out of a tarp backpack, how to make a fire out of sticks, you know, with the bow drill methods. And, you know, in general, how to take care of yourself and sort of starting from a place of not really knowing anything to kind of coming into eventually towards the end of your stay being a leader in the group. We used to call it forced success because you couldn't, you know, part of graduating was learning all the skills. And a lot of the young people who came didn't feel that they were very good at anything and didn't feel that they could accomplish much. So it was a big deal for them to come to the place to discover that actually that they could learn how to do things that most people in the world don't know how to do, which are levels of basic care and survival that, you know, hey, I can actually live out in the wilderness. So there was like a general, and the focus, although people had psychiatric diagnoses, the focus of the program really was not the pathology. It was more kind of what, you know, them building resourcing and building skills to be able to become a stronger person and then also being able to deal with some of their challenges from the place of their resources.
And how do you think that having this happen actually out in a wild place helped? And let's drop off the skill learning because, I mean, honestly, you could learn how to make a fire, in an alley in a city if you had to. So what was so special about this being in nature and how did that help them?
You know, it helped a lot. And I think even more than, gets generally verbalized in most wilderness therapy programs. You know, humans like to think that they're the ones out there doing the great therapy and making it happen. And I'm not saying there isn't some great stuff happening. And I was one of those therapists, but I can honestly say as one of those therapists that I felt like, having what I would call the lead guide or the lead therapist be the wilderness, that my job was so much incredibly easier than it ever would have been if I tried to meet with somebody in an office. And the things that happened for it was actually rather enjoyable to work there, which people might not think that because they're like, oh, you're working with some of the most difficult people. But you know, the change that happened for people was rapid. And you know, usually you could say, sound like I'm selling wilderness therapy, but I'm not. But it was miraculous to see what could happen for people in the wilderness in 24, 48 hours. I mean, kids would be begging me in 48 hours. I can go home because I've had so many breakthroughs. Let me tell you what I've discovered. And on some level, they were accurate because they had probably in that 48 hours had more realizations about themselves than if they had, you know, gone to like a year of therapy. And then, of course, there was a whole lot more to learn. And it was, you know, it's just being out there. It's simply just being out there. And I mean, you've been out there. I mean, we've all, like, if anybody's been camping, like, wilderness therapy aside, when I go guide a program for 11 days, I know that I'm going to be different when I come back in at the end of those 11 days. Because every time I go out there, nature, makes me stronger, gives me something in some way, even things I don't even ask for. Sometimes pushes me, challenges me. It's not always like easy stuff, but it's like the next thing. I always get the next thing. Like this is the next thing. So that's what happened. You know, you grow. It makes you every day that you spend out there and give yourself to it. Nature is just a healing place to be. I feel like in some level, it's not like it's even trying to necessarily do that. It's not like trying to heal me. It's just that it is so itself. It is so healthy and so itself. And in the human world, we're so kind of, mixed up. You know, we're confused. We have so many voices in our head and what do I follow and what do I think and this and that and this and that. And nature is so healthy in itself that when we go into the field of nature, when we just put our being in the field of nature, it, like, just like if we put our being in a field of really strong, healthy human relationships, that can help make us stronger. But even stronger, so like nature, we put ourselves in that field and we become stronger, more ourselves too.
So in your essay that was so great, you mentioned that Laura Sewell offers 5 practices to cultivate ecological perception. Do you remember those or do you want me to read them off?
No, I have them right here. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Could you go through those, please?
Yeah. The first one is, learn to attend. So the basic is just to, you know, getting out of our heads. I think that's one of the hardest things. It's just step one, but for people is that if you just go for an hour hike once in a while and you have a really busy lifestyle and a lot going on, it's really easy to just quote, go for a hike and go out there and just be out there in your head trying to figure some things out. And it's not that like we can't always, you know, stop our head from doing what it's doing. But it's a bit like choosing that whatever our head's doing or not doing, that we're choosing to bring our awareness to pay attention to all the others, to receive, to look around, to be pulled in by the forms and textures of nature, to just let ourselves be noticing, even enchanted, you know, paying attention to everything out there, more so than whatever's happening in us.
Which, by the way, every one of these steps that you say, I just want to make explicit, is also true in intra-human relationships. You can certainly improve intra-human relationships by learning to attend to the other person as opposed to what I'm projecting is going on.
Yep, exactly. And I think that's our having a relationship with nature improves our ability to have human relationships because nature teaches us how to be in relationship in some ways better than the human world can teach us, depending on the humans we're around.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. I was just going to take you to the next step of Laura Sewell, unless you wanted to talk more about the first one.
That's where I was heading to. Okay. So the second one was perceive the relationship between things. And so, yeah, this kind of just comes back to what you're just saying, the relationship, like how do, you know, even just the question of how do we be in relationship and watching how things are in relationship in the natural world, like noticing, where, ocean hits the sea and noticing where roots go into the earth and noticing where the horizon of land meets the horizon of the sky, you know, noticing where the tree leaves blossom out from the branch. Just, you know, where an animal meets the ground. So we're like noticing how things interface everything. One of my favorite places to do this actually, I mean, you can do it anywhere, but I've spent a great deal of time in Costa Rica and, you know, and not recently, but in years past, I used to work as a yoga teacher there in the winters and the rainforest, which is such a powerful ecosystem, and the ocean, which is such a powerful ecosystem. Like my favorite was to just watch those two have a conversation, like just, because they're both so powerful, they're like individually, they're so powerful, but then to see them meet and the way that they interchange is incredible. Anyway, but you can do it anywhere and you might even see like that's one that attracted me, but you might notice where are the particular places that you feel most called to notice the relationship between. And then the third one is develop perceptual flexibility. And, you know, that's in some ways a sense of kind of seeing, like time. Joanna Macy always talks about the concept of deep time that I love, like looking at things in deep time, which is much different than human time of, you know, my human lifetime or even the next year. But how long, I mean, when you look at how long, I know the trees where you live in particular, like how long trees have been here, how long they have lived, and how long everything else. It's like they are, like when we think, are they our elders or not? Well, yeah, they're our elders. I mean, how long have they been here and how long have we been here? So they're older. They're older than us. They're elder. And so, you know, and kind of even using your imagination, even in what you know about history, you can even look back at, you know, what, who was here 200 years ago or 300 or 400 years ago, you know, just that long sense of time, in how things go.
And I think about that a lot with, on both ends that I can, and I think about how, I think about something that, Vine Deloria said to me a long time ago, that he said that his students, when he taught at the University of Colorado, they might go hiking for a weekend, and that's nice, but that hasn't really developed a relationship with nature. They've had what he called an aesthetic experience, that to really get to know a place takes, I mean, I've learned that living in this place for 20 years, that my, I feel like no matter how much I loved the land when I was here for the first month, like I knew nothing. And the longer I live here, the more I realize it's like the learning curve keeps getting steeper and steeper every day. And also the fact that there are, like you said, the trees live a long time, and then, you know, grasshoppers live for a summer. And it's, I don't know what point I'm making, just that there are all these different timescales that are just interacting in very complex ways that is just extraordinarily beautiful.
Yeah. And, you know, I think there's actually so much more we could say about this, and thanks for bringing that in. I think, you know, I long for what you describe your relationship to be on the lands, because I actually haven't. I've visited places. I have long relationships with places that I visit again and again on an annual basis, you know, for a couple of, 15 years or so, or more, or a little bit less, depending on the place. So I get to know them over time because I spend time every year in those places, but not, I don't have as, you know, maybe that same long relationship. And I think a lot of people in the world are missing that because of, you know, don't always have access to a wild place. But, I would say that even if you don't have that, if you have that, my gosh, what a blessing that is to cultivate that long of a relationship with a place. I mean, that's what we're really meant to do as humans, on the land. I mean, the original humans did migrate and did have relationships with different places, but they were migrating in the same general area of places. So they, you know, developed relationships with those areas. You know, I have a little bit of that in that I've like, befriended like even a particular tree and visited it, you know, more days than not for years, you know, spent time with it every day. And that's a great practice to pick a particular place on the land and over years just spend, even, you know, whether it's your place or it's a place, you know, near you, but go back to that place, you know, often all the time. And that really will do, I think, some of this deepening, you know, rooting in one place with a relationship being over time is very different than just having one conversation with a being. Yes.
You know, and I keep coming back to how, yes, the relationships are different with non-humans because we are different species, but there are really similarities, because the same is true with friendships. You know, you can have a friendship that develops over 20, 30, 40 years, and there is a certain comfort that comes from talking to an old friend. And I guess for me, in my work, that's one of the things I keep trying to do is to hold in my heart and in my head the simultaneous facts that these others are shockingly different, that a bear's perception is radically different than mine. They have very poor eyesight, but wonderful sense of smell, and they have bear interests as opposed to human interests. But at the same time, we're all just fellow travelers who are doing our best to get along. They are extremely different intelligences, but also we're all just, like I said, fellow travelers.
Yeah, and you know, that brings in a great point, what you just said too, and that is that getting to know the others, like, what is their story? Some, you know, who are they? And yeah, like, if can they tell you their story? And sometimes that's taken more time than, say, me just having, you know, just having an initial conversation, or even a being that wants to, you know, sometimes beings are generous and might, you know, show me something about me or life or whatever. But some of the most deepest, potent conversations I have are simply when the others told me about them. In whatever way, showed me, told me, you know, so somehow I could understand what their world is like, what it's like to be them, what it's like to live their life.
Well, and think about this again in human terms, that pretend that you're at a party and everybody there is a narcissist and they actually couldn't care less about you. And so you wander around and everybody is saying, hey, let me tell you what I did today. And let me tell you what I did yesterday. And let me tell you about my great life and all the amazing things I've done. And then maybe once in a while you encounter a person who says, hey, how you doing? And sometimes I feel like that's how we are in when those of us who care about the non-human world, those of us who perceive the non-human world as having things to say, I mean, I almost feel like sometimes it's a little bit of a shock to the others. Like, oh my gosh, a human actually cares what I think. I don't know. You can take any of that any direction you want.
Oh yeah, yeah. Like you're this is great because you're just reminding me other really great things to say. But and that is that I think it's true. And this might sound really bizarre, but I'm gonna say it anyway. And that like I guide in certain places over and over again. So you could say those places are kind of used to human conversation because every year I, maybe sometimes others, other guides. Sometimes, like, that place has had many conversations with humans over some years. And then I've gone to other places where, you know, I can almost feel like somehow that, like you said, it'd be a shock if I, like, started to have a conversation. It kind of reminds me of, like, I was in high school, I was, like, super shy, right? So once it occurred to me, like, oh, like, I think I should just start talking to the people around me. Well, mid-year, I'm like, okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to start talking. Like, well, I hadn't been talking for 2 months, so I just opened my mouth, and then everybody, like, looked at me, like, what just happened? You know, and they're like, you know, and I, like, that's kind of like what the beings in nature who've never been talked to by a human, I feel sometimes like, maybe not all the time, but sometimes like that shock you're talking about. But other times, other places, like when I go back to the places I guide, it's like they know, like, we're coming because we've come before. We've done it again and again. And the place, and a place feels different when it's talked to by humans and interacted with by humans than when it's not. I don't know if I can describe how it's different, but it's like, all places are animated, but you can imagine like a human, if you imagine a human that never got spoken to, nobody ever talked to it, what that human's face or demeanor or energy might be like, that everything just walked by it and never talked to it. And then you can imagine what a human looked like who you interacted with and talked with and people were like interested in. I mean, there's a difference in that, how those two different, like, say, young children or humans would look. And it's similar with nature. It they're affected by how we relate to them.
You know, a great example of that is I mention all the time that I see bears almost every day. And part of the reason that started is because, you know, I live on some land that's also basically in a neighborhood. And most of the people here don't like bears at all. And my mom, and I too, my mom loved bears. And the bears discovered that this is a place that they wouldn't get chased off. And this took a long time to develop any sort of trust at all. But now I routinely see bears sleeping. I mean, they sleep on the porch because they have learned through generations that this is a place where they're not going to get shot. And a real quick story. I just heard this from, you know, there's all those terrible fires in Australia, and there was a woman who's done a lot of rescue work on kangaroos through her life. And in the midst of these fires, she woke up one day and there were 35 kangaroos in her garage. And they were, some of them were kangaroos that she had raised and then released into the wild. And others evidently had just heard the news. And the point is, they knew a safe place. It's like, we're going to go back, you know, everywhere is in flames. Let's go to where we knew we were safe. And I just keep coming back to, yes, it's extraordinary and wonderful and beautiful to have communications with non-humans, but on another level, it's not any big deal. It's just, you know, you and I are having this conversation. It's no more big deal than the fact that you and I are having this conversation now.
Yep. I agree with you completely. And I saw that story. I read that story too. And it reminded me a little bit of, I knew a woman in Costa Rica who rescued monkeys who were abandoned. A lot of the monkeys there were, mother monkeys were getting, hurt from the electrical wires. And then they were finding babies that had been living on the mother's back and were alone. And so this woman would rescue these babies and she would raise them. And then once they were old enough, she would take them back to this particular national park and let them go. Well, occasionally she would go for a walk in that national park. And whenever she went for a walk, all those little babies that were now adults that had raised her, they came to see her and to jump on her and to say hi.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story. So can you talk, we have about 5 or 6 minutes left. So can you talk for just a minute about the Animas Valley Institute?
Yeah, let me just name two, the last two things that we didn't speak about, the last two practices, perceiving depth and, receiving images, from the imaginal self. And these are related to Animas. And that is, you know, the one about re-perceiving depth is just seeing ourselves as of the earth, like we are, like our soul is in the soul of the world. Like one of the things that we say, it's actually in Bill's Wild Mind book, is that, you know, we're kind of planting people back into the soil of earth. Like humans belong in the earth, in the soil. We're of the earth. We're wild beings too. We're animals ourselves. And also we're souls. You know, our soul is in the soul of the earth, is in, which, you know, is connected to our imagination. You know, that's kind of what, you know, one of the ways you can perceive soul is through image, one of the main ways. And so we're connected to the earth's soul, the world's soul, our soul is. It's not, you know, a lot of times people misinterpret the word soul as like, oh yeah, I'm going on my soul journey for me. And it's like, I'm going to, but you know, that's just not, I mean, we are connected to the earth soul. So, you know, one of the great definitions that Bill uses of soul is that, it's the niche you were born to occupy. So it's not about, like, it's my niche. It's like that, which has to do with my relationship with everything else. The world soul, everything in the soil, the earth. And so I'm finding my place in those relationships. And I really can only live my soul or embody my soul if I'm in those relationships in the way that I'm meant to be. you know, that's kind of what the work of Animas is, it's two main themes. One is wholeness and the other is soul. And wholeness is, you know, replanting ourselves in earth. It's, and I had that in my story, like it's sort of like, resourcing our wholeness, you know, planting the finding and discovering those strong parts of us rather than focusing on the pathology as a lot of, psychology does, which just, you know, creates those stories which take us out. But we need to be rooted in the resources of what we come from with the earth, which is, you know, kind of rooted in a relationship with dreams and the natural world. They can guide us. They can tell us what to do. They can tell us in terms of they guide us in all sorts of ways. I mean, there is healing to be done. You know, that is part of it. And a lot of things with therapy too is they focus a lot just on healing. You know, like that's all we got to do. But you all know, you know, we could just heal like for several lifetimes and we still wouldn't be healed. So the focus isn't, you know, like let's just heal everything. It's more like we'll heal what we need to heal as we go. But the idea is for us to be whole and to live our purpose. And so, you know, there's going to be things to attend to along the way as we move towards that. But that is the reason, you know, is that, we want to be planted in the earth. We want to be in relationship with the earth. We want to be who we are and live our purpose. And if we had enough people doing that, you know, things would be very different in the world. And so it's like, is the more people that we can, have transition to being able to experience that, the better it's going to be for all of us. So that's kind of what we do.
So a couple more questions. One of them is, what is an animistic perspective?
An animistic perspective would be that everything is alive and sentient. So everything is a being. Everything, like, we're, you know, humans aren't better than anything else. We're like, we're a particular subset of creatures in the larger web of life, and we have a important relationship to be in with everything. But we're just, you know, kind of part of that web, and everything else is alive as well and meant to be in relationship. And really, this relates to the fifth one here, which I didn't talk about too much, but it's in my story, which is about being co-creative, and that, you know, really humans are meant to be co-creative with nature, which means we're meant to be in a particular kind of relationship where we can really work together as co-partners, in that we each have different gifts and roles that we can offer each other. And so if we're in a relationship where we can perceive the others as sentient beings who have things to offer us and things to say, and then there's ways that, there's things that can happen. There's things that we can create or dismantle or do, or, you know, the possibilities are endless for what we could do if we are co-creative partners. And that's really what we're meant to do. Because we're meant to live in a web of relationship that's that way.
So if anybody wants to know more about your work, and or specifically if anybody wants to go into the wilderness with you, how do they learn more about your work, and how do they actually and how can they actually have you help them with reconnecting to nature and reconnecting to themselves?
You mean how can they find me, or
when is your book coming out? How can they read more about your work? And then also, I mean, you and I met, I don't know, 8 months ago, 6 months ago, however many months ago, last year, and you were just getting off the river. And how, if they want to participate in any of that, how would they do that too? Those are the two questions. How do they learn more about your work? And if they want your help, how do they get it?
Probably you can reach out. I have a website. It's just my name, RebeccaWildBear.com, which has my email and my phone number on it. So you can always reach out and contact me if you want to continue the conversation further, if you want to hear about programs, if you want to just work one-on-one. There's also Animus has a website that's just animus.org, and that has all their programs with my other co-guides as well, all the programs that we do all year. So probably those would be great ways to follow up in terms of seeing what else. All my offerings are on my website for the year, river programs as well as my Animus programs. And, you know, there's good scholarship programs right now with the Animus Institute. So, you know, a lot of times people think they can never have those options because of the cost, but they're really doing everything that they can now to make it available to anyone who's really, really strongly interested. So don't let that part hold you back. And my book is, it's forthcoming, but I don't yet have a publisher still. So I'm, still seeking. So I'm not quite sure that's exactly when that's going to happen yet.
Okay. Well, is there anything else you want to say about conversations with the earth or with specific non-humans before we wrap it up for today?
I would just say that, don't let wherever you are living, stop you from going to have conversations. It's great if you can get out in a wilderness setting, like as wilderness as you can, and go have a conversation, but you can also go into your backyard. You can also walk down your street. I have a busy street here. I walk down and I still, interface with the natural world. So there's an opportunity everywhere, anywhere, anytime with any natural being. And I hope you do.
So I want to say one thing, and then you say one more thing. The one thing I want to say has to do with what you just said, that, you know, you can see this wonder anywhere, that, you know, I've lived around grasshoppers my whole life, and only maybe 10 years ago was I was sitting out in a little field, and I saw a mother grasshopper sticking her abdomen into the ground, and she had dug a little hole, and then she was planting seeds, or not planting seeds, she was planting eggs, and it was just like a sea turtle, except, you know, she's only an inch long. And the point is that, A, it had taken me 50 years of living around grasshoppers to actually see this, and B, you know, even that, it was just one of the most beautiful experiences of that entire summer, was to see this mother passing on, and you can see that anywhere.
Yep. Yeah, you can be surprised by what shows up. A lot of the time when you go out there, you don't think certain things are going to happen, and then they do. So, yeah, I would say, and it's also great to get to a really wild place as well, if you can. I mean, really, it's, I would say in our culture, it's so hard to unplug ourselves. It can be the way the world is, and the phones and the cars and the computers, to unplug yourself for an hour, for a day, for a week, to get out there and listen, it's like, it changes everything.
Well, thank you so much for your work in the world, and thank you for being on the program, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Rebecca Wildbear. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.